You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Yes, yes, you are indeed tuned into The Wire. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko skapres toku ingoa. Nō mai harumai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Thursday Wire for Rāpari, Thursday the 14th of February. It's Oscar, your host, and I'm, as usual, joined by Ben and Grace. How are you guys today in a maximum of 5 words?
Good. We are good.
Oh, yes. Wow. That's a collective 5 words. Well done, team. On today's show, Andrew Little returns to talk to myself about Parliament returning, the polling that has been done at the start of the week, and gamespersonship in politics. Grace talks to Janfrey Wakin.
Yep.
Of Child Poverty Action Group about the Salvation Army State of the Nation report. I talked to Green MP Chloe Swarbrick about the mental health pilot that launches in Porirua this week. And finally, on this day in history, 2011, what started, Ben?
The Bahraini uprising. Another little fun topic I'm doing here.
Indeed, no, it's a good one today. Very packed show, so we may as well get right into Andrew Little, I guess.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Obviously, they give a readout of the New Zealand public at a point in time, which is what this is. I guess from our point of view, we tend to look at movements and changes, and the reality is you have to look at them over time. And this is the first re-poll done in roughly a year. There has been quite a marked change, and that change is outside the sort of marginal sort of change. So there has been a shift, clearly. I think that does show that, and that's encouraging, that's positive. It certainly, for those who are on the kind of the winning end of the poll numbers, it certainly gives you a psychological boost. And I know from bitter experience, but if you're on the other side, it can be a pretty depressing experience.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, as you said, the numbers that were produced were positive for Labour. What intricacies of kind of like these polls, though, do you think it's important to remember when looking at these released polls, like sample size, etc.?
Yeah, no, I don't think sample size is a problem. There's a methodology that goes with it, and the polling companies have, there's a kind of an industry standard about making sure that the returns are properly weighted. So in order to get that poll sample of 1,000 or just over 1,000, they'll actually probably have made close to 2,500, even 3,000 calls to make sure that the actual poll sample that they draw the numbers from have the proper proportion of rural voters and metropolitan voters, Māori, non-Māori, other ethnicities, all that sort of stuff. So it'd be a properly weighted sample. I guess the thing to bear in mind is these things do have a margin of error, so it can be 3-3.5%. Bear that in mind, which is why it changes from one poll to the next over a period of time that are the most important thing to look out for. Where you see a dramatic change, where that change is outside that 3-3.5% margin of error, then you know there has been an actual shift one way or another, and that's what we saw in this poll.
Do decisions ever get fully made based on the back of polling numbers?
They are a factor that gets taken into account. Again, I think it's what happens over a period of time. And I think if there is if there's an ongoing declining trend, then you've got to, at some point, say, this is not going the right way. And you explore the reasons for that. Sometimes it can be explained, sometimes it can't. And so you use it for those particular reasons. But equally, there's a lot of intuition involved. There's a lot of your own readouts and feedback that you get for all MPs just in their engagement and exchanges with the communities that they're a part of. So it's a factor. I guess the difference with polls is that there's an element of science to it. They get big headlines and a lot of media coverage. And there is one sense in which a story about a poll is going to feed a sense amongst others. So people reading about it or hearing about it or seeing it think, oh, so that's what's happening, and adjust their views accordingly. And there's a self-fulfilling prophecy aspect to it if you're not careful.
So Parliament returned this week. What does that mean for you and for just generally how the government works? Because we see headlines about politics over the course of summer still, but now Parliament is officially back. So what difference does that make?
Well, I mean, we go through kind of the ceremonial and more routine things. So we have a thing called the Prime Minister's Statement, which is the first item debated each year. That's been debated this week. That means that the process of lawmaking resumes, and also the process of examining government departments, their financial performance, their whether they're actually achieving what they set out to do, and the scrutiny of law as well. We saw, and that's why I think the incident yesterday when a select committee was due to meet and some people didn't turn up on time and the National Party walked away from it, collapsed that select committee meeting. There was a whole bunch of government departments lined up to be examined and quizzed and interrogated about their financial performance. That didn't happen, which is unfortunate because that's a very important accountability process.
So there's the reports of that. There were comments made about people needing to get out of bed and actually do their job in relation to that. Was that just a sensationalized version of what happened, or was that genuinely people just didn't show up for it?
No, what happened was a regular member of the committee was unwell, was unable to make it, had called in to say he was unable to make it. Then it's the job of that's a Labor Party member, it's the job of the Labor Party to then find a substitute, and it took a while for the substitute to be arranged and to get to the meeting. They were a few minutes late, but the National Party MPs on the committee decided that they weren't there at the start time, therefore they weren't going to participate. That collapsed the quorum, so the meeting couldn't start, so it didn't. And what it meant was, and they had a meeting, the meeting was scheduled to go from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m, so because there's a lot to do, so a whole lot of government departments lining up ready to be cross-examined and interrogated about their performance, that didn't happen. That'll all have to be rescheduled. So I kind of get the point about punctuality and making sure the numbers are there, but I don't think it justified the level of inconvenience that has now been caused.
Certainly. Do you think that shows anything about National's willingness to participate cross-party or cross-floor?
Oh, I think there's a point at which I think that if they can give the appearance of the odd bit of chaos here and there, the lack of organisation, that somehow makes them look good. I don't think it's a particularly good way to approach the job that MPs have of providing scrutiny and accountability. I get the political point scoring, I get that point, but in the end, there's other important aspects to the job that you expect the responsibilities to be discharged. And it was a political gesture. It allowed them to make a point later in the afternoon in Parliament that, the government's asleep on the job, all that sort of stuff. It's not correct, but that's what it was about.
Yeah, that feeds quite nicely into my next point, kind of talking about scrutiny and political point-making and optics. Again, looking at the reports back from the opening days of Parliament, there was kind of like a predominant focus on, I would say, two members of Parliament, those being Opposition Leader Bridges and the Deputy Leader of the Coalition, Minister Peters. And their interactions, it was described kind of by some sources as jibes and jeers. Obviously, you can't talk for Mr. Peters. However, why do you think, and this isn't limited to New Zealand Parliament or to politicians within the Parliament itself, but why do you think that many feel the need to level their critique of opposition at basic insults, like I would perhaps suggest was done on the opening day of Parliament?
I mean, at the heart of the day-to-day conduct of politics are people, the politicians, and it is deeply psychological. So, and I think from the media's point of view, Gallery, they got to report every twist and turn every day. And one of the things they report on are the kind of interpersonal exchanges between politicians when they are performing their job, particularly in Parliament. Winston Peters and Simon Bridges have a bit of history. Simon Bridges took over the seat of Tauranga, which was once upon a time Winston Peters' seat. So they know each other from there. So the media is always looking for that bit of frisson between those two. You've also got the most seasoned politician in Parliament, and Winston Peters. He's been around a long time. He is very canny. He is, in my view, very astute. He is very good sort of finger on the pulse, if you like. And you've got Simon Bridges, who, I know Simon's been in Parliament a few years. He's the younger of two of them. He is making his way as leader of the opposition, leader of the National Party, still very early in that role. And I think the media sort of looks at these two and becomes an interesting story. But, politics is a game of passion. It is about ideas, and hopefully it's about ambition for the country. But it's that clash of ideas and clash of passions that is what makes it sort of newsworthy and interesting. And in the seed of those sort of interpersonal conflicts, you get a narrative about the competing ideas and policies that go to make up government. And that's what I think, that's what feeds the stories, that's what makes it interesting to a lot of people, makes it dead boring to a lot of others, but that's why, you get the headlines and the stories that you do.
I'm not saying that the behaviour is to catch headlines, but as you said earlier, the National Party used the walk out of the committee meeting to essentially score points. But do you think that actions should be chosen based on what grabs headlines? Is it an important thing that needs to be part of politics?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing is that it's partly for internal consumption, but also for your party support, your voter support base, is that, you know, your supporters want to see that you're doing stuff and you're in the media and that you're making the point. So, you know, politicians are looking for opportunities to show that they're on the job, they're doing things, that they have a few ideas that might be useful, and so those sorts of things happen. And then because in Parliament, in the parliamentary precinct, when Parliament is sitting, everybody's here and you've got a dedicated press gallery following what Parliament does. So there's a whole sort of mishmash of things that come together that can elevate things to a level of significance that actually on close examination they probably don't justify. But that's just the nature of the day-to-day operating of 120 people very passionate about what they do, very committed and dedicated to what they do, along with, you know, 30 or 40 journalists following their every move. Look, there'll be any number of politicians who wake up every day thinking, all right, I've got this great thing I'm going to say or this great thing I'm going to do and I'll get lots of coverage and nothing ever happens. And then, you know, the most incidental of things happens and it turns into a big story. That's the nature of it. When I said before about politics being a game of psychology, it's also a confidence game. And there's a constant thing about, particularly in opposition, keeping your side of the house buoyed up, feeling confident, being able to do the job of taking on the government and challenge the government of the day. And it is very hard for the government. Obviously, you want to keep your side of the house buoyed up too, which is a lot easier to do when you're in government, in power, you're making decisions that make a real difference.
Do you think that you can gain that same amount of confidence by levelling legitimate political critique of policy and legislation at the opposition, or is it just an easier fix to play against what may be seen as obvious weaknesses? Like we see with President Trump, there's a large portion of people that level their criticism at him being old, having thin hair and small hands, when perhaps there's actually a lot more that can be done to criticize him in his policy, which would be more productive for the government and the public that they represent?
Yeah, I think the public has an appetite for two things. Of course, they want to see serious issues being seriously debated and good solutions put up for it. And I think most people agree for a lot of complex problems, there's no one single answer, but they do want to see a good debate about it. But equally, and because this is a day-to-day thing, people are, and basic human nature, that you do want to look for the odd point of humour and the odd point of levity. And while I think we all take our job seriously, we've got to be careful we don't take ourselves too seriously and that we can laugh at ourselves, that we can, when things are going well, we don't kind of get over the top about it. When things are going badly, we don't kind of beat ourselves up about it to the point where we just don't do anything anymore. So I think it's about ensuring that public debate over important policy and political issues isn't devoid of humanity and the wave of emotions that goes with all those sorts of things. And I just think that the day-to-day record of politics and the conduct of politics ends up recording all those.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
Yes, that was Andrew Little, who started by answering on what he and the Labour Party take away from polling. He aha o whakaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we'd love to hear from you. Tuka patu mai, send through a text to 5395, or why am I? You can call the studio to chat with us on 309 3879. Next up, we have Grace.
Yes, so on Wednesday, the Salvation Army released its State of the Nation report, which reviewed the government's proposed wellbeing budget for 2019. I spoke with Janfrey Wakeham, co-convener of the Child Poverty Action Group, about what the report tells us about how those in poverty will be affected by the new budget. So I started by asking her about how government policies up to now have affected children in need.
Awesome. Let's get into it.
Well, I mean, they're critical, but unfortunately they have not been particularly radical in terms of changing the numbers of children who are being brought up in poverty, and that is really what's required right now. I mean, we've had a situation in New Zealand for a decade, actually, going back to the early 90s when benefits were cut so drastically, and we've had measures that help that, but they've bounced around, but there are still high levels of children in poverty, particularly Māori and Pacific Island children. But numerically, there are more non-Māori in poverty, but proportionately, there are more Māori in poverty, children in poverty, than any other ethnic group.
So why do you think we're still seeing such high rates of poverty in New Zealand?
I mean, for one reason, children don't vote. So the political forces that shape policy are not as strong for children as they are for other sectors of the community. And we see, for instance, that the elderly are treated much more generously in our society than children under the age of 18. So we feel as if those changes that really are needed for children to be lifted out of poverty, and their families who support them, of course, need the kind of support that we have made available for the elderly, and particularly on income measures.
So what is Child Poverty Action Group's take on the government's new wellbeing budget?
We're heartened by this approach. There's no doubt about it that the simple formulation of income is simply too unidimensional to be helpful, but we really need to know what this wellbeing will mean in reality. But it's marking out a different pathway, and it's one that not just focused on short-term economic matters, but also including social and environmental concerns, and those are very important to families, in fact, to all New Zealanders.
So the Salvation Army State of the Nation report states that while the wellbeing budget amends many things for New Zealanders in poverty, that policy should be policy already, so it doesn't do enough. What do you think about that?
We feel as if what the Salvation Army are alerting public to is extremely valuable, but we also feel that there have been insufficient changes in the short term that could have been done, that could have made a big difference to the people who are most struggling. And for instance, the fact that December 2018 quarterly statistics from MSD show that 100 million was spent just on emergency grants. So when you've got top up, you just know that there's a desperate policy failure, and that the measures that were introduced in the 2018 budget were fine and it's encouraging, but they're not radical enough, and immediate things could have been done to lift the poorer families out of, or give them some relief, not necessarily pull out of poverty, but at least give tremendous relief. And of course EPAG is most concerned about the Working for Families tax credit package, where the discrimination against caregivers and parents who are not fulfilling the paid work requirement are denied the $72.50 per week, and that is a huge amount of money for people who are on a severely limited budget. So, you know, those sort of measures could be introduced. They haven't been. We feel as if Salvation Army is absolutely spot on in trying to alert politicians and the public to make much more radical changes to policy.
So what do you think are the main problems with the government's current approach to children in particular below the poverty line?
Well, I don't think they're taking the urgency of the problem seriously enough. We've set up this birth advisory group and we're welfare advisory group, and we're very keen to hear the outcome of that. But there's a whole delay. We're not sure that the budget that's coming up will have measures that are absolutely urgently needed right now, immediately, to achieve significant change. So we feel as if welfare benefits should be increased by at least 20% immediately, that they should be indexed to wages, like superannuation is, and get this full tax credit package for Working for Families. Families and others on benefits have just had to wait too long, and they shouldn't have to wait for budget 2019 and thereafter, because change is needed now.
The report also states that while there is an argument that wellbeing is individual, it is also up to the whole society to make sure that no New Zealanders are unnecessarily in poverty. So what do you think that balance is?
The problem with the wellbeing target or approach is that averages will mask individual circumstances, and that's why some of those questions that the wellbeing approach raise are yet to be answered. But I think the Salvation Army Base of the Nation report was current with EPAG ideas that it's the outcomes that matter, and these outcomes must be measured, and the Child Poverty Reduction Bill will be useful for this, but we've got to be attentive to the poorer poorer families and not simply lifting certain numbers out of poverty. It's the most needy that we've got to be targeting first.
So what would you say to people who would say that it is more about personal responsibility for families instead of government always providing benefits or extra money for people who don't have enough?
But yeah, it's a very common argument, and while there is some element of personal responsibility that is involved in everybody's lives, we know from endless research and internationally and locally that when there are good support structures around families that enable good educational outcomes, safe communities, access to good health measures immediately in their communities, then individual choices actually have a small part to play, but government policies have a massive part to play, and that where people who may have had some good fortune sometimes overlook just the arbitrary nature of some of the circumstances that fall on others, as well as the incredible effect of colonisation and racism that have insidious and multiple layers of disadvantage.
So do you think there's any main things that the government could do to alleviate unnecessary poverty in New Zealand that they have not covered in the wellbeing budget?
There have been measures that could have already been done that haven't been done, and there are huge amounts that could well be supported in terms of growing prosperity that's shared fairly, communities that are supported effectively to assist with drug and alcohol issues, these, and of course housing is such a massive problem. So there are just so many aspects of elements of poverty that government can play a role in, and the State of the Nation report has been very effective at highlighting these. The thing is that the State of the Nation report is commenting on the first wellbeing budget in 2019. And, you know, we're all heartened by that, but we need to know just what the wellbeing budget means in reality. And that's why the State of the Nation is very good, because it's saying, look, these are the outcomes, and they've picked five policy areas. Of course, in terms of child poverty, they all impact on children. But in terms of a child poverty action group, the things that we can do immediately are the things that affect the hardship, people living in hardship without good access to housing, health and educational possibilities. So, you know, there are a number of social hazards in the community too. So State of the Nation has been effective at targeting those particular aspects of the wellbeing budget. And I think that's helpful for anybody looking at what could be done, what government policy could do. Big questions there.
They are. They're very big questions. It'll be very interesting to see how the budget affects people in poverty.
Well, it may be of interest, and it's really important, especially for young people, and they're the people that you're talking to. The DPAG analyses the budget every year, and it's now been announced yesterday that it's going to come out on the 30th of May, which is later than usual. And we have a budget brunches or breakfasts all over New Zealand, but one in Auckland will be at Mount Eden Memorial Hall on a brunch on the 31st of May. So if you want to be alert to that and get people along, then there's a good analysis by our experts that look at the way in which this wellbeing budget will actually play out. So, and for a young generation, it's absolutely critical, because it's your future, not so much those of us who've been around for longer.
It's very important, yeah.
It's vital, and that is the point. We've got to get people making the government do these things, because they need to be bolder, and they're not. And young people are very, very important. You'd be a fantastic force saying, this is what we deserve, this is what we expect, this is the kind of community that we want to grow up in, and our children too. So, and politicians will only follow what the public are telling them. They won't initiate, they will follow. So that's why public opinion is so important, and it needs a lot of people saying the same thing, getting to them, and, you know, enforcing that understanding that what good for actually the very poorest people means a better society for all.
That was Child Poverty Action Group talking to Grace. We'll be back after a little break.
Bang Bang China Cafe, your late night dumpling lover's dream. All the thrills and flavours of Dominion Road and, well, China, squashed into the only place in the viaduct with zero ocean views. A gut-sizzling range of shumai, potsticker dumplings, steamed buns, dan-dan noodles and utterly delicious loads more. For a quick dumpling fix or late-night karaoke shenanigans, head to Bang Bang China Cafe. Open 7 days from 6 till midnight. Enter via St. Alice next to Dr. Rudy's in the viaduct.
Just because the party's over doesn't mean you have to stop partying. The 95 BFM Gold After Party. Celebrate with the BFM team as they continue to throw down for 50 years. With DJ Stinky Jim, Dubhead, Songs Jukebox Parlor, Tina Turntables and Penny Black vs. Swap Meet, and the mighty combination of Mikey Havoc head-to-head with the Professor. The 95 BFM Gold After Party. Whammy Backroom, February 15th. Free entry with your gold ticket. Thanks to Smooth Drinking Southern Comfort, Deep Creek Brewing Company, and Whammy Backroom.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Yes, we're back after the break. And
Lachlan's here.
Lachlan is here again for another week, another Lachlan. Now we have a piece. I talked to Chloe Swarbrick from the Green Party about the new mental health support program pilot thing for under 25s that was released earlier this week in Porirua. I started by asking what was encompassed in this program.
Yeah, so on Monday this week in Porirua, myself, Julianne Genter, who's Associate Minister of Health, and obviously Green MP and Minister of Health, Dr. David Clark, announced the first rollout of the pilot to provide free, accessible mental health services to those between the age of 18 and 25. You know, this comes from a long and arduous campaign from myself and a number of those in civil society, speaking to the point that these services just simply aren't available, and when they are, the time, wait times are ridiculously large, but also the costs associated and the hoops that you often have to jump through if you do want to get some form of financial support are just far, far too difficult. So the whole point of this pilot is starting to fulfil the confidence and supply agreement between the Greens and the Labor Party to see free mental health services available to all people in this country under the age of 25. And it's a really meaningful first step. It's the first time that we will see through a number of different touch points, whether that is self-referral. There's a number of different ways to do it, from calling the government number 1737 through to self-referral via app, or, you know, just popping into your GP, touching base with the local school, or even just turning up at one of the local clinics. Young people will be able to get access to these services, and there won't be the wait times typically associated with putting yourself forward for these kinds of services either. But what's actually really exciting about it for me is that it's not just going to be typical talk therapy. There is a range of different services available for people. And, you know, people will be able to go between what works for them. The one that is most exciting for me is peer support. And I think that peer support workers are the mental health workers of the future, insofar as they are people who have experienced, you know, and have first-hand experience of mental trauma and mental illness, and are able to work with young people who are experiencing the same thing after having been trained up and certified themselves. So that goes some way to addressing the concerns that the Health Minister has raised in the past with regard to the employment and training up the workforce.
Certainly, I think peer support and self-referral are really, really massive steps for a mental health system, as those are really core issues for a lot of people, especially when it comes to crisis management at some points.
Totally.
Sadly, that does get to that point a lot of the time. Will all of the proposed functions of, like, the future mental health program you look to implement be available in this pilot, or is this, are there some things that won't be rolled out in this pilot and saved for a kind of full-scale rollout?
Well, the intention and what I'm advocating for as the Green Party MP and my vision for mental health services in this country is to see every person in this country be able to access services when they need them and have those services be culturally appropriate and fit for purpose. So one of the cool things that is also inbuilt into this pilot, and it's quite different from a typical governmental pilot, which most people will you know, think of as being quite a bureaucratic process. It actually has inbuilt a 90-day system where it learns and reflects on itself, and that's happening with the collaboration of the University of Otago doing studies on the efficacy and access, and the pilot will then change according to those learnings what's worked and what hasn't quite worked. So I think what we'll actually end up with is not just, you know, running the same thing over and over for, you know, the 6 months or onwards as it's rolled out throughout the rest of the Greater Wellington region up to Wairarapa by the end of this year. But we'll also see a program that becomes greatly improved over that period of time.
Certainly. I think a huge part of the mental health program that and just general health programs that aren't always often addressed are the perhaps societal causes and kind of the what some people say are the causes and others will label as compounding factors. So how do we create a mental health program, or how does this program reflect and or address the kind of inherent societal causes and other compounding factors, like such as poverty, trauma and isolation that may not always be considered?
Yeah, those are the three things that I spoke about in my response to the Prime Minister's commencement speech in the House yesterday. You know, and I began it by acknowledging that I'd actually had a really terrible night's sleep because I had had another call about yet another young person in Auckland who had attempted to take their life. And this is you know, far, far too frequent. I'm often coming up against particularly older people who are telling me that all we need to do is teach younger people resilience. But, you know, it's not as simple or as straightforward as resilience. The world has changed quite drastically and things are far more unsustainable and insecure than they perhaps ever have been, particularly if you look at the data. You know, we have the highest rates of inequality that we've had in this country since the 1980s when we first started collecting data. We have the lowest rates of home ownership since the 1960s, and half of our population is renting. You know, if you look at the employment market, it is no longer a linear career path for people, but there is very much the gig economy where we're being expected to all go out and get degrees, but in getting degrees we're having to take on huge amounts of debt that follow us for our entire lives. So these are the things which were actually considered in the Mental Health and Addictions Inquiry, which I was hugely supportive of. First and foremost, because it went outside of the space of medicalising and pathologising issues of mental ill health, and recognising that even if there are underlying issues biologically or otherwise with people, you know, or people may be more susceptible or inclined to exhibit mental ill health, there are absolutely environmental factors that can trigger them or exacerbate them. So what we need to be looking at is a whole overhaul of the system, and that is in education, it is in health, it is in housing, it is in the justice system, it is also in employment, it is in power dynamics inside employment relationships. And this stuff's never going to change overnight, but I think it's a starting point of recognising that everything is connected, and that the mental ill health crisis or epidemic is just the pointy end of a whole raft of other issues in our society, and that we need to be looking under the sheet and really addressing those and tackling them head on. If I can just have one other point, it's that, you know, there's absolutely a really key association there with addictions and substance abuse, and they are very similar driving factors in terms of poverty, trauma and isolation. And it is obviously the case that our current responses to substance abuse and addiction with regard to the legal and criminal system in particular only perpetuates those issues, particularly of trauma and isolation. And we cannot expect to solve any of these problems if we continue doing what we always have done.
What other steps can we take to make interactions with the mental health system safer for those who feel vulnerable or perhaps disenfranchised from the system that you speak about?
One of the major things that I picked up talking to particularly young people all around the country, but also older people as well, is that it's becoming increasingly difficult to demarcate what is a normal level of stress and when that stress passes the threshold into something that is unsustainable and maybe mental ill health. So I think that if we're actually able to, and this is what I've started to characterise as quite a solid point of rebellion, to be perfectly honest, if we're talking about the system, which is so fundamentally flawed in so many facets, if we're able to start talking to each other openly and clearly about our struggles, and, you know, not just resorting to the internet, which quite typically actually showcases a curated version of completely the opposite, i.e. our best lives, then I think that if we were able to build these communities and to talk to each other and to build those peer support networks without necessarily, you know, the training, but that training we are going to be building out and hoping to build capacity within networks. But again, I don't think that volunteers should be expected to be the backbone of this, because this is where everything has fallen downhill to begin with. If we can enable people to feel comfortable about talking about their issues, even if they don't necessarily know the answers, then I think we're taking a great leap forward. It was Zoe Palmer, who's a fantastic young advocate, she's 18 years old, from Nelson, who advocated for CAM services in her regions, who said that, you know, when she was advocating for mental health services, she spoke to her own personal experience with mental health. And obviously, you know, that being a background of some quite negative experiences, but particularly that of anxiety and depression. And spoke about how in advocating and in revealing her past, she was told by a whole bunch of officials, for lack of a better word, that she was endangering her future by talking about these things. And I think it's quite ironic that on the one hand we're telling young people they have to be open and speak out if they have an issue, but on the other hand, doing so is going to jeopardise their future. So we have to deal with that cognitive dissonance, and we have to actually, quite frankly, get rid of it. We have to make it okay for people to speak about their issues and not to know how they're necessarily going to solve them.
That was Green MP, well, Green Member of Parliament, Chloe Swarbrick. Now we have...
my segment.
We do indeed. So
what's that called?
I don't know.
Citizens, to this day in history with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Yes, this day in history, going back to 2011 for the start of the Bahraini uprising. The country had been a colony of the United Kingdom well into the sort of mid to late 20th century, finally reaching independence from Britain in 1971, having been an important source of oil.
Bahrain. 36 years ago, oil began flowing here. It brought prosperity, a prosperity that has been wisely used to serve the people of this island state. This is the new town of Isar, one of the most ambitious welfare projects undertaken so far, which, when completed, will rehouse one-fifth of the total population. To date, it has cost £6 million and represents not only an achievement for Bahrain, but for Britain too. Together with many other British contractors, Wimpy's, the British construction firm, was chosen to design the entire project. The houses are planned for all income groups in three price ranges on a large site donated by the ruler, Sheikh Isa bin Suman Al Khalifa. Jetliners from all over the world regularly fly industrialists in to this commercially attractive land. But the planes arriving on this day were bringing representative well-wishers from many governments to attend the formal inauguration of the new town, a place of beauty as well as of functional merit. The spiritual as well as the physical needs of the population have been well provided for. Isa Newtown is, in every sense, a wonderfully successful achievement. This day was one of celebration for a people who realize that their welfare is being well cared for. The popularity of His Highness the Ruler was in no doubt as he arrived at the new Olympic Standard Stadium for the inauguration ceremony. The man who had made it all possible presented a commemorative key to the first resident of Isa Newtown. Formal Arab custom still had its place in the 20th century setting before the celebrations began. In the arena, 2,000 schoolchildren, the Sheikh's daughter amongst them, gave an impressive display. A football match between Bahrain and England was another highlight of the celebrations, which lasted for 3 days. The impressive fleet of limousines had brought the ruler and his distinguished guests to watch the England International Amateur 11 make its first appearance in this part of the world against the Bahrain national team. The English boys, who were personally greeted by His Highness, had flown out especially for the match. Naturally, most of the 11,000 crowd were hoping to see the home side win. But this was an occasion where the long-standing friendship between Britain and Bahrain was expressed in terms of sport. It was the game which mattered more than the result. The two captains exchanged banners and then, in the unaccustomed heat for the visiting 11, the Bahrainians kicked off. The strong English team quickly got the measure of the home side and pressed attack after attack. It was a very entertaining match. A perfect way to launch the stadium on its sporting career. The final results gave victory to England 4-0, but the generous crowd showed no disapproval. And it was in the same generous mood of hospitality that a sumptuous feast was staged at the government palace. The banquet was an occasion of luxury in typical Arab style. The diners were honored guests in a land where much was being achieved for the comfort and well-being of the people. It was indeed worthy of celebration on a grand scale. Already 750 families were settled in their new homes, homes they can afford, their health, education and material needs well catered for. The new town of Issa had been born, and over 90 British firms had played a vital role in making it possible.
That was part one of This Day in History. We'll be back after a little break.
Finn Andrews is doing as so many blushing brides have done before, and leaving behind the veil.
Love, what can I do?
Yes, the Veil's frontman is releasing his debut solo album and playing an intimate live gig to celebrate. If you want to win yourself tickets, then all you have to do is grab your Simplicity B card and stay tuned to 95 BFM Drive all this week.
Score.
95 BFM presents Finn Andrews, March 30th at the Auckland Town Hall Concert Chamber, with support from Red Fountain. Tickets on sale now from banishedmusic.com/tickets.
It's music. The originator.
And it beat me all the way.
95 BFM, the original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95BFM.com.
So now return to This Day in History. When we left off, Bahrain was becoming independent from the United Kingdom. And it sort of went along for a few years as a sort of parliamentary democracy, but increasingly the ruling party consolidated power. And leading into the 1990s, you had a series of uprisings that were suppressed.
The Gulf state of Bahrain has been rocked by a series of demonstrations against the Al Khalifa regime. The civil unrest includes street riots and the bombing of hotels.
Neighbours of Bahrain are nervous that unrest could spread across the region. On the tiny island state, repression has spawned a climate of fear. And as Sue Lloyd Roberts discovered, any filming of the opposition must be covert.
A routine afternoon in Bahrain where demonstrations and arson attacks take place daily. To the outsider, it looks more like Israel's Intifada than the Gulf states, once renowned as desert oases of stability and reliable friends of the West. The Shia people, the majority here, are in revolt. They're demanding a say in a government which is dominated by the Sunni ruling family. It helps to dress up as a local, and you have to entrust yourself to an opposition network that operates in devious ways in a country where scenes like these are strictly out of bounds to journalists and people are imprisoned simply for talking to the BBC. Within minutes of any trouble, the area is cordoned off by riot police, thousands of whom have been imported from the Indian subcontinent to restore order to an island the size of Singapore. Their commander is British, their approach thorough. They round up anyone they find, beating them as they load them onto jeeps headed for brutal interrogation and jail. In another part of the village, they were just as active.
This one is my grandfather.
Yes.
The police came with tear gas and rubber bullets, the boy says. His grandfather's age was no defense.
Because he was trying to protect my... They shoot three guys who's running here. But this was about 5 meters only. By what's called chauzas, I think.
And so what is this? Can you show us what this is? What do we got?
It's rubber chauzas.
They showed me how the police rampaged through their house, and although everyone's keen to tell the story, they're fearful of reprisals, and I'm begged to conceal the faces and voices of those who speak to me.
They deserve everything here. No? They deserve everything without any reasons.
How many policemen were there?
About 35.
35?
Yes, maybe more even. And you can't say anything. If you want to see anyone, they'll just hit you and hit you. If you are a child, woman, old man, they don't care.
It's behavior that fuels fury and increases demands that the government here should be made accountable. Even small children who get in the way of the intruders are kicked and beaten.
They want to silence our voice. They want to steal our rights. All you want is a parliament. It's the right of everyone in this land. Only through parliament will we get our rights and will the crimes of the government be discovered.
Bahrain got rich on oil and foreign banks and businesses flooded in to enjoy the boom. Links with Saudi Arabia have always been close, even more so after the Saudis paid over £1 billion for the 18-mile causeway that now links the two countries, and the Saudis are watching events in Bahrain with alarm. Sheikh Al-Khalifa runs the place like the boss of a large company. One brother is prime minister, the interior minister is his cousin. His power is absolute. He dispensed with the constitution and parliament over 20 years ago, to the despair of former MPs.
Since the parliament was dissolved, there is no respect for human rights. We are living in a complete state of fear. We do not want to change the government. We just want political reforms. We want to stop corruption, to have social justice, and a fair distribution of wealth.
Unfortunately, they would not get these things, leading to further protests, which began on this day in history, 2011.
Pro-democracy protesters have clashed with police in Bahrain. Hundreds of mainly Shiite Muslims held demonstrations on the outskirts of the capital, Manama, and in villages across the country. Bahrain is ruled by a Sunni Muslim monarchy, although some 70% of the country's population are Shia Muslims. Riot officers fired tear gas and rubber bullets to break up the demonstrations. One man was shot in the leg. The protesters want a greater say in the running of their country's affairs. The Shiite majority has long complained of discrimination by the ruling Sunni minority. The use of force appears to go against earlier promises made by the Bahraini government to allow peaceful protests. The demonstrators called it their day of rage, a nod to the recent popular unrest in Tunisia and Egypt.
Yes, but what happened next was that the Bahraini uprising was one of the less successful of the Arab Spring. It got pretty heated, and then the Saudis went in with their military with the sort of tacit support of the United States, and it sort of crushed the uprising, which I think it sort of lingered on, but it's really sort of ebbing away, and it's just been some recent elections in Bahrain that have been very criticised.
There seems to be like a similar kind of flow on from a lot of these, the spring ups, but...
Yeah, it was sort of one of the least successful. I think partly just because it's a small country that no one's heard of, and that's why the Saudis were allowed to go in and just commit sort of massive human rights abuses.
Sounds similar to what's currently going on in Yemen.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for this day in history.
Yeah.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another day, for Thursday the 14th of...
Valentine's Day. Did we mention that?
It's Valentine's Day. It's also the day that...
I just like to say to our listeners, I just hope you're alone like I am.
Yep. Just, yep. Like us all.
You're never alone when you have The Wire.
Yeah. You know? and you have been. You always have been. That was the show for today. A big thank you to all of those who spoke to us today. Janfrey Wakeham from Child Poverty Action Group, who spoke to Grace about the State of the Nation Salvation Army report. Chloe Swarbrick, who talked to us about mental health reform and a mental health pilot, which is being launched in Porirua this week for those under 25. Andrew Little, who talked to us about polling, political point winning, and parliament restarting. And a big thank you to Ben and Grace, as usual, for helping this show go so smoothly.
Yes. Yeah. And I accept your thanks.
That I'm glad that you do. I was quite concerned that you wouldn't. Anyway, we'll leave you with Fridge Crank Gun from Evian Christ before Te Hotaka o Te Ahiahi, the 1-4 with Sigrid.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.